Let's get kinky. You're listening to the Funny Dom Podcast.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the show. This week, I'm going to talk about the upcoming Valentine's Day kink event, The Great Get Off. I'm going to clarify what the hell that is. It's a new concept. It's an event that I put together with two other dominants. So I'm going to talk about that, unpack that. And also I want to talk about, first off, a kind of a dynamic realization that I've just defined recently. It's on the topic of punishment for a dominant. I think a lot of people in dynamics, they can reach a point where it's a little bit uncertain, because if a submissive misbehaves, or even in the relationship, make some kind of mistake, the dynamic itself can be used to process and resolve that, you know, through the device of punishment. And that can be a really healthy way that dynamics, you know, work in a relationship. But I've heard people say before, and I've certainly been in a situation of being uncertain about, what does the dominant do when they make a mistake? Obviously, besides acknowledgement and, you know, trying to not make that mistake again, what do you do in the relationship? What do you do in terms of your partner? And I think it's obvious that something is needed. You know, the dominant can't be punished by the submissive. That would not be comfortable for either. But there should be an equal element. You know, not the same thing, but an equal element. And I've always thought that, but it was difficult to define exactly how to express that and frame that very simply. And recently, I had the experience where I made a mistake with my long-distance partner, Miss Cheeky. Many of you might follow on Instagram. And I missed a story time, you know, connection time that we had. And we talked about it, and she was stabby. She gets quite stabby, and of course she was, and had the right to be. And she was, you know, very, very soon, you know, in just a short amount of time, a day or so, she was ready to forgive and get less stabby. And we're going to, you know, do that that makeup kind of connection time. But even I felt like that's not enough. You know, if she had missed something that she was expected to do for me, you know, for us, then there would be discipline, there would be punishment. So I actually thought of the term demonstration. And I think this is a good way of framing it. And this might help you in your dynamic, or at least in your understanding of dynamics itself. So when a submissive misbehaves or makes a mistake, they can be discipline, they can be punished to cathartically release any guilt and to make up for what they did and to learn a lesson to do better. I think a dominant needs to demonstrate. So in terms of that situation I described, I demonstrated to Miss Cheeky by giving her bedtime stories for the week. So for the next 7 days, instead of, you know, the once or twice that we have as a set structure, I called her every single evening to tuck her in and give her a story time. So it was a way of continually giving a thing that she needs and expects and loves, and doing it as a demonstration of not just acknowledging that that mistake, but also saying, I'm going to rebuild, you know, and cast and rebuild that trust that was shaken by this act. And I think it worked really well. And I think demonstration is a good way of describing that behavior. So if you're in a dynamic, and if you're a dominant, and you do something that maybe just wasn't what you had planned on, and there's a little bit of an expectation of you know, something being, you know, fixed or done better, look for a way to demonstrate that. And it has to come from you. So the submissive cannot plan or construct the demonstration. Maybe they can suggest or ask for something, but I think it should come from the dominant, because that's part of the demonstration, is this happened and I am sorry about it and it was a mistake. But not only am I going to say it won't happen again, I'll do my best to not let it happen again, I'm going to demonstrate something to kind of help, you know, rebuild that and give it some ritual, you know, in the same way that a submissive would, by taking punishment. So submissives can take punishment, dominants can demonstrate. If you resonate with that, you know, please feel free to send me a message or ask questions about it. We can get that discussion going. If you have another way of dealing with that situation in your dynamic, let me know. You know, maybe you have found and constructed a different or a similar, you know, way of progressing through that kind of issue. And before we get to your questions, I've got a bunch of questions to get through this week. I want to talk about the Great Get-Off, the event that I've put together for Valentine's Day. It occurred to me that Valentine's Day is, it's a bit boring, I find, and a lot of people do or feel the pressure to do something because it's Valentine's Day, you know, and maybe there's not a lot of interesting or kink-friendly things to do, especially depending on where you are. I thought some kind of online event would be good that people could do from anywhere, especially if it wasn't anything too, you know, confronting or intimidating. And people have been asking about music a lot recently. People seem very interested in what, if you do listen to music, you know, what I listen to, what I like to listen to during play, you know, in a scene. And I thought, that's like a playlist. I have a playlist. A lot of people have a playlist. And I thought, well, what if we all shared a playlist? And then I thought, well, that's fun, but what if we all shared a playlist at the same time? And I thought, ooh, that's interesting, because it's a way of being connected to possibly countless people all around the world, listening to the same music at the same time, playing together, but safely, you know, apart, still with boundaries. You know, you're either on your own, you can be solo, or you could be with a partner, or you could be with many partners. You know, it doesn't actually need anything except your presence, your time, and the start time and the playlist. And that's kind of where the idea for the Great Get-Off came from, because I thought it would be so, like, exciting and hot and communally connected to have a bunch of people around the world playing while you're playing, listening to the same music. You know, you're having that very present moment and enjoying what you're experiencing, and then in the back of your mind, kind of remember, like, oh wow, you know, there's all these people around the world that are kind of having a similar kind of experience right now, and I wonder what they're doing, you know, while this is happening here. You know, yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I don't know if it's been done like that before. That's basically what it is. You buy a ticket. It's like you know, it's like $5 or $10, you know, and you get the start time. You get a playlist that is put together not just by me but by two other dominants as well, Black Queer Dom and Cynthia Leone. You might follow them on Instagram. Two amazing dominants. We're all kind of curating the tracks, so there'll be like a, you know, an hour, 90 minutes of kind of music from three dominant minds, you know, music that we like to play to, that kind of, you know, brings our energy up. And I'm also going to write a solo submissive play session plan for people who want to play solo. So not only do you get the music and the start time, you get a specific plan of what to do and how to play to help you get into a subspace, while also knowing that there'll be many other people following the same plan, again, with the same music. So when you're you know, on your knees and, you know, preparing yourself to play, you know that there's many others doing the same thing, many others doing as they're told, following instructions. And I feel like that's very validating and very connected. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to play as well. I'm going to, knowing that there's many others playing with their partners and solo around the world in different countries, listening to the same music I'm listening to. Oh, whew. Yeah, I think it's very fucking hot. So that's what the Great Get Off is. It's in my stories on my Instagram page, The Funny Dom Returns. Go and check it out. The link is there. It's an event online, so you can grab a ticket and then you'll get the playlist on the day, which will be, depending on where you are, it's going to be on that kind of 14th, 15th for Valentine's Day. And you'll get the playlist and the session plan and the start time. Obviously, if you're not able to be free on that exact start time, then you'll still have the music and the playlist, so you'll still be able to do it that day. But if you're free at that exact time, you better join in the exact time. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. And then maybe the next day, people can write in and say what their experience was, what track was their favorite. You know, maybe share a little bit of what they got up to. And I think if it's a positive experience, as I think it will be, we could do this every year. This could be our very own Valentine's, you know, kink play event. So, yeah, that's the Great Get Off. Grab yourself a ticket. A bunch of tickets already sold. But I think I've put the, you know, the capacity at like 1,000 because we could sell 1,000,000. You know, there's no limit to how many of us can play together in this way. So go and grab one and be one of them for the first year, and let's all get off together.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.
Now let's get to some questions now. Got plenty of great questions through my weekly Q&A on the Instagram page. My first one, do you feel that contracts between DS are necessary? Trying to navigate this space and embrace my submissive side. No, short answer, they're not at all. Really, very few things are absolutely objectively necessary. And they are obviously, you know, consent and communication, you know, vetting, safety. They're things like that. Everything else really is negotiable. It's really got to come down to a compatibility thing. You don't need to have any kind of contract. You do need to have communication and negotiation and agreement, which is, you know, like a verbal kind of contract. But in DS, when we say contract, we mean the actual formal written agreement in the style of a contract, which, you know, is a commonly done thing. And you can totally do that even for a new relationship. I've heard of some people that use a contract for a brand new partner. You know, before their first play session, they might want to use some kind of contract, and that's totally fine and valid and has a practical, functional, you know, logic to it. Other people use it as more of a commitment ceremony. You know, the relationship has progressed to a certain point and they want to build a contract, you know, as a form of commitment. So it's really up to you. It's not necessary. You can do it. If you like the idea, I would say talk about it with your partner. If your partner wants to do it and you're not sure, tell them you're not sure. Ask them why they want to do it. Maybe you can get a better understanding together of why it might be a good thing or why it might not. Thanks for the question. Next question, how do you feel when your sub calls you daddy? Thank you, sir. Have a good day. This is a great question. This is from a dear friend who recently actually asked me this question conversationally, and it made me feel a certain way. And I said, that's a good question. I'm not sure I've been asked how it feels before to hear that. you know, just what I think about it and what the, you know, process and the threshold is, but how does it feel to hear it? And I think she really liked the answer. So thank you for asking that again in this space so that I can answer for everybody else. It feels, what I told her and how I kind of, you know, reflected that it felt, a way to get this across, is it kind of feels like, I see the image of a soundboard, like a recording board with all the levels. And it's like all the levels, you know, like there's like 12 or 19 levels, and they all go up at the same time. Like they all just go, it's like a powering up. And that's how it feels. It feels like a kind of refueling of all these different energies, you know, at the same time. So I feel like I'm taking a kind of like a breath of energy, and I feel power. I feel territorialism. I feel pride. I feel a protective urge. I feel a ruining urge, you know, a sadistic urge. Like these kind of mutual things all kind of going up at the same time. The urge to, like, you know, grab the back of a head, to grab a hair, to grab a throat, but also to protect, you know, all that at the same time while feeling like I've grown an inch taller, you know, and my chest feels like it has four lungs of air instead of two. Like it happens a little bit just talking about it right now. That's how it feels to me. That's why it's such a big thing. And it feels like a key, you know, in a lock. Like it feels like it's such an identity thing, which is why that is a threshold for me. And I do get that on a much smaller degree with just Sir. Sir does that as well, but not in such a visceral way. So yeah, thanks for that question, sweetheart. Sir, what are some rules you have for your littles? I'm feeling bratty and need some. Well, first of all, I'd say feeling bratty doesn't mean necessarily that right now you need a rule. I would say right now it means you need some space to be bratty. It is okay to feel bratty and to let that out. And part of what I like to do with a bratty sub is to be a container for that. So a container may, yes, it may contain, but it also has space within it for what is in it to exist. So if you feel bratty, I would first suggest to find a way to let that out in a fun, you know, safe and consensual way. I recently told someone I was working with who had some brattiness to, you know, put on some music and dance, you know, and dance in a rebellious, cathartic, releasing way, you know, and maybe even be a little bit, you know, bratty directed at me, you know, because I can contain that, like, that's fine. And I'm asking you to do it. I'm giving you that as a task. So it's still in a healthy, functional kind of dynamic container, but it will also help you let that energy out and also validate that that's not bad. It's not bad to be bratty. In terms of rules, I go fundamentally always with the self-care variety. I would look at your bedtimes. I would look at your meals, your exercise, how you're treating yourself. Are you pampering yourself? Are you looking after you? Are you giving yourself space to be a brat, to be a little if you're a little, or a pet if you're a pet, a slave if you're a slave, whatever kind of sub you are? You know, you could be a little and be all those things as well. Are you taking care of all those sides of yourself? Are you looking after you? And I would enforce that first. Those would be the first rules. I hope that helps. And keep being bratty. Next question. Newbie, tired of online DS life. In-person events alone or bring non-kink support friend? Yeah, tired of online DS life. No wonder, it's barely a life. If you're doing everything online, it's a lot of energy sometimes to not get a lot back. You know, if you don't make good connections and people disappoint or are inconsistent, yeah, of course, it's not going to be enough. In-person events alone or bring non-kink support friend? Always bring a friend. Not a question. even if they're not into it, if they're a good friend and they're supportive and they're open-minded, why would you not want a buddy system? Yeah, bring a friend, be there together, observe things together. You can hang out, you can talk about it afterwards, you know. It's safer, it's more fun. Definitely the way to go. Let me know how you do if you go to your first event with a friend. Let me know. I hope you have fun. Next question. Got any favorite toys to use? And do you have any toys you have for yourself? Well, I would say all my toys are for myself. Most of them are for use on a submissive partner, though. And my favorites, that's difficult. I like so many of them. Obviously, I really like impact, so I do like the floggers and the canes. I do like my bamboo canes, my paddles. I have a nice like steel, maybe it's aluminium. It's a nice metal kind of paddle that's got a heart on the end and leaves a little heart shape. I like that one. I like my rulers. I've got two or three like rulers that are quite fun. And my wands and the dildos are great. So many of them are good toys. Ones for myself, you mean for the play, like a, you know, more like a male sex toy. I did have a, one of those, you know, sleeves that you can, like, you know, masturbate with. But I kind of broke it, which I remember joking to Bunny about. I sent her like a photo, I said, look what daddy did. And I think I got a bit too vigorous with it, and it actually split, you know. It wasn't completely ripped apart, but I kind of ripped it and broke it. I must have fucked it too hard. So, yeah, I have been meaning to maybe get a new one. I do like those, the ones that are see-through, because I'd like to be able to see it, and I'd like to have a partner use it and be able to see, you know, to see me through it while using it on me. I hope that was a helpful or interesting answer to that question. Thank you. Next up, does instructing / being dominant, also per messages, only give you energy or deplete? I wouldn't say it depletes. It does give energy. It does take energy. It kind of does. It depends on what else you're doing. Like being, I do get the question like this quite a lot. People ask, like, how can you do what you do, or is it exhausting, that kind of thing. And no, if I'm in a good place, like if I'm, that's kind of my responsibility of self-care and grounding. That's up to my other practices. If I'm rested, if I'm balanced, then it can't exhaust me, because it is a very kind of give and take thing. You get energy from it. You put energy in, you take energy from it. It's really up to you to kind of be in the balanced state where you can do that. So if I'm very, very tired, then that is more difficult. It is more challenging. But otherwise, if I'm in a good place, like I can be in a dominant kind of headspace for, you know, 6 or 7 hours in a day, you know, which is, I suppose, a lot, but it doesn't feel like I'm depleted at the end of it or exhausted. I definitely need some grounding and some rest, but not in a negative way at all. So I would not say it depletes. It definitely does give, and it's really up to what you're doing besides that in order to put yourself in a good place. And I think that's probably the same on the other side of the slash as well. And that's why being in any kind of frenzy can also be bad. It really takes away the time from the rest of your life where you can have good practices for yourself, ground, spend time in different, you know, headspaces and rest and exercise, whatever your, you know, lifestyle has in it that isn't that, to balance you out. It's really about being as balanced as you can be so that you can be involved in that give and take of power. Thank you.
What has been your favorite part about your self-collaring journey so far? I hope that it's going well, and it seems like it is, and I'm just curious to see and hear.
It is going well. Thank you for asking that. For people who, if you're not aware, I've been undertaking a self-collaring process, and I am actually more than halfway through now. I believe it's week 7. It's a 12-week process for me. That's the process I've constructed. If you're interested in self-collaring, if you want to know more about it, then I did just write a guide to self-collaring that you can get on the Patreon. So, you know, subscribe and grab that to know a bit more about this process for me and about how you might be able to go about that for yourself if you're interested. My experience has been really, really good. I'm still halfway, so I'll have a better view at the end of it of what I've enjoyed the most. I think right now the overall goal, like having a single-minded focus on practices in order to invite growth and the earning of something that I want to, you know, give to myself and undertake and use as an artifact of growth and of acceptance and embracing is palpable, kind of on a daily, you know, basis for me. And that's what the practices remind me of. Has it been easy? Absolutely not. Not for the past few weeks. The first few weeks were very easy. I was getting into it. I was enjoying everything, perfecting it, you know, finding the best ways to do things and kind of improving at each thing. But yeah, around when it got to the kind of halfway mark, one trip up in my schedule where I was out of town, and the whole thing got very shaky. And part of it has been accepting that and letting go of that perfectionist kind of, you know, focus, because that is not helpful and not healthy, and accepting that the process is about not giving up. It's about getting back into it, even if that's constant, you know, like that's what it is, because you're reproving to yourself as you go, like, I'm still doing this. I'm going to do my best, you know, each day with whatever the practice is. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the journaling, the fasting, the exercise. I'm definitely feeling a better energy physically and mentally. I think several of the practices I will just continue with, I think, you know, like the kind of having a fasting day, or a, you know, even if it's just like a half day, that kind of ritual I've really enjoyed. And definitely the exercise, I want to keep those things going, because they are based on things that I do want to have, you know, as regular parts of each week anyway. So, it's been really good. I definitely recommend people, no matter whether you're a sub or a dom, to consider it and look into it. And I think you might find you get a lot out of it. I definitely am. Thanks for the question.
To ask about some scenes that you'd like to try but haven't had the chance to yet. Thank you.
I'm sure there are many. The one that is still in motion, which I've planned with Bunny for a while now, and we've made steps and communicated a lot about it, and I have kind of several parts of the actual scene in my head, is a dual dominant plan for her. So to have two male doms in a scene to double dominate her. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And we have talked to a couple people about it. And yeah, we're hoping to pursue that in the near future. I think that'll be a lot of fun and a big threshold for both of us. And yeah, I rest assured when it happens, and we're ready to talk about it and share, you will hear about it, because I think it'll be a lot of fun, very hot, and be really, really interesting to explore that together.
I believe that subs primarily exist on a spectrum from lace to leather. And I identify as lace. What kind of subs have you encountered, and what advice would you give to a baby sub learning who they are?
That's a fascinating way of seeing the spectrum or the identity that a submissive may have. I'm not sure I agree with it in a way. Like you see, there's definitely spectrums involved, but it being that kind of one flavor to another, I think people can be a much more complicated mix. So if it's a straight spectrum from lace to leather, and I'm assuming lace is more softer or less extreme, less intense, and leather is more, you know, intense, maybe more bondage kind of orientated, I'm guessing. Like there's a logic to that, but often people are kind of the far end of that and also the early bit of that. So I don't think you kind of, I don't think people place along that. If it's like 1 to 12 and you say, oh, I'm more like a 7, it's like, you're more like you're a 7, a 2, and a 12, if that makes sense. So I've definitely experienced partners who are often a mix of those things. Some people definitely place at either end quite, and that's a bit more simple or less complicated, I suppose. But I think most people are kind of a mix. Like I would say that for myself, even with the kind of, I've seen the definitions of there being like a hard dom, soft dom. I've never been really comfortable with that because I identify as both. You know, I think it's a bit simplistic to be like, oh, you're like a caregiver, so you're a soft dom. It's like, well, you know, all dominance should have a caregiver aspect. And for myself, it's quite intense and extreme, but so is the sadistic side. So what does that mean? Does that just mean I'm both, or does that mean that way of defining things is a little bit simplistic? I think it's the latter. So yeah, I've experienced both and everything in between. And in my experience, most people are a kind of pie graph mix. You know, you have different parts of your identity that's mixed in together. And I think it's better to allow that so that you don't pigeonhole yourself or push yourself into being, you know, in a spot that you might not be completely. You might have a little bit of that over there. And if you're more open to that, you might be more likely to discover it as well. But yeah, thanks for that question, Lace. And if you're a baby and you want to discover it, I think it's through experience. Keep open to what you might be into and experiment and explore. Thanks for those questions, folks. Feel free to send in a voice message question I can use on the show and answer and discuss. And if you'd like to ask a written question, then look out for my Q&A on the Instagram page, which is every week. And I'll answer them there and answer some here. So thanks to everyone who sent in your questions. I hope you enjoyed the answers. And that brings us to our regular segment at the end of the show. It is our continued reading of Diana Gabaldon's Outlander. We're going to pick up where we left off. So I hope you're relaxed. If there's a bit of noise in the background, it might be Ra, who is digging into a treat blanket. That's where I get a little treat, and I wrap it up in her Snoopy blanket and tie it in a knot. And she attacks and and pulls the knot out, undoes it, and gets to the treat, which she does quite determinedly and ravenously. So you might hear a little jingling of her collar as she does that. She's nearly already gotten to the treat. She's very clever. So let's see. We're up to page 49. If you're reading along, get your copy. When tomorrow came, though, we had other things to do. I had forgotten that we had planned a day trip to the Great Glen and Loch Ness. It was after 9 when we arrived at the Loch End, and the guide Frank had called for was awaiting us on the edge of the loch with a small sailing skiff. "Annie, it suits you, sir. I thought we'd take a wee sail down the loch side of Urquhart Castle. Perhaps we'll have a wee bit of sup there before going on." The guide, a dour-looking little man in weather-beaten cotton shirt and twill trousers, stowed the picnic hamper tidily beneath the seat and offered me a calloused hand down into the well of the boat. It was a beautiful day, with the burgeoning greenery of the steep banks blurring in the ruffled surface of the loch. Our guide, despite his dour appearance, was knowledgeable and talkative, pointing out the landmarks that rimmed the long, narrow loch. "Yonder, that's Urquhart Castle," he pointed to a picturesque stone ruin above the loch. "Or what's left of it. 'Twas cursed by the witches of the glen, and saw one unhappiness after another." He told us the story of Mary Grant, daughter of the Laird of Urquhart Castle, and her lover, Donald Don, poet son of MacDonald of Bonehutton, forbidden to meet because of her father's objection to the latter's habits of lifting any cattle he came across. An old and honourable Highland profession, the guide assured us. They met anyway. The father got wind of it. Donald was lured to a false rendezvous and thus taken, condemned to die. He begged to be beheaded like a gentleman rather than hanged as a felon. This request was granted, and the young man led to the block, repeating, "The devil will take the Laird of Grant out of his shoes, and Donald Don shall not be hanged." He wasn't, and legend reports that as his severed head rolled from the block, it spoke, saying, "Mary, lift ye my head." I shuddered, and Frank put an arm around me. "There's a bit of one of his poems left," he said quietly, "Donald Don's. It goes, 'Tomorrow I shall be on a hill without a head. Have you no compassion for my sorrowful maiden, my Mary, the fair and tender-eyed?'" I took his hand and squeezed it lightly. As story after story of treachery, murder, and violence was recounted, it seemed as though the loch had earned its sinister reputation. "What about the monster?" I asked, peering over the side into the murky depths. It seemed entirely appropriate to such a setting. Our guide shrugged and spat into the water. "Well, the loch's queer and no mistake. There's stories, to be sure, of something old and evil that once lived in the depths. Sacrifices were made to it. Cain, and sometimes even wee bairns, flung into the water in withy baskets." He spat again. "And some say the loch's bottomless, got a hole in the centre deeper than anything else in Scotland." "On the other hand," the guide's crinkled eyes crinkled a bit more, "'twas a family here from Lancashire a few years ago, came rushing to the police station in Fort Augustus screaming, as they'd seen the monster come out of the water, hide in the bracken. Said 'twas a terrible creature, covered with red hair and fearsome horns, and chewing something with blood all dripping from its mouth.'" He held up a hand, stemming my horrified exclamation. "The constable they sent to see come back and said, 'Weel, bar the dripping blood, 'twas a vera accurate description.'" He paused for effect. "Of a nice Highland cow, chewing her cod in the bracken." We sailed down half the length of the loch before disembarking for a late lunch. We met the car there and motored back through the glen, observing nothing more sinister than a fox in the road, who looked up, startled, a small animal of some sort hanging limp in its jaws, as we zoomed around a curve. It leapt for the side of the road and swarmed up the bank, swift as a shadow. It was very late indeed when we finally staggered up the path to Mrs. Bard's, and we clung together on the doorstep as Frank groped for the key, still laughing over the events of the day. It wasn't until we were undressing for bed that I remembered to mention the miniature henge on Crane Dun to Frank. His fatigue vanished at once. "Really? And you know where it is? How marvellous, Claire." He beamed and began rattling through his suitcase. "What are you looking for?" The alarm clock, he replied, hauling it out. Whatever for? I asked in astonishment. I want to be up in time to see them. Who? The witches. Witches? Who told you there are witches? The minister, Frank answered, clearly enjoying the joke. His housekeeper's one of them. I thought of the dignified Mrs. Graham and snorted derisively. Don't be ridiculous. Well, not witches, actually. There have been witches all over Scotland for hundreds of years. They burnt them till well into the 18th century. But this lot are really meant to be druids, or something of the sort. I don't suppose it's actually a coven. Not devil worship, I don't mean. But the minister said they're a local group that still observes rituals on the old sun feast days. He can't afford to take too much interest in such goings-on, you see, because of his position. But he's much too curious a man to ignore it altogether, either. He didn't know where the ceremonies took place, but if there's a stone circle nearby, that must be it. He rubbed his hands together in anticipation. What luck! Getting up once in the dark to go adventuring is a lark. Twice in 2 days smacks of masochism. Ooh. First mention of S&M in Outlander. Page 52, mark it down. No nice warm car with rugs and thermoses this time either. I stumbled sleepily up the hill behind Frank, tripping over roots and stubbing my toes on stones. It was cold and misty, and I dug my hands deeper into the pockets of my cardigan. One final push up over the crest of the hill, and the henge was before us, the stones barely visible in the somber light of pre-dawn. Frank stood stock still, admiring them, while I subsided on the convenient rock, panting. Beautiful, he murmured. He crept silently to the outer edge of the ring, his shadowy figure disappearing among the larger shadows of the stones. Beautiful they were, and bloody eerie too. I shivered, and not entirely from the cold. If whoever had made them had meant them to impress, they'd known what they were doing. Frank was back in a moment. No one here yet, he whispered suddenly from behind me, making me jump. Come on, I've found a place we can watch from. The light was coming up from the east now, just a tinge of paler grey on the horizon, but enough to keep me from stumbling as Frank led me through a gap he had found in some alder bushes near the top of the path. There was a tiny clearing inside the clump of bushes, barely enough for the two of us to stand shoulder to shoulder. The path was clearly visible, though. And so was the interior of the stone circle, no more than 20 feet away. Not for the first time, I wondered just what kind of work Frank had done during the war. He certainly seemed to know a lot about manoeuvring soundlessly in the dark. Drowsy as I was, I wanted nothing more than to curl up under a cozy bush and go back to sleep. There wasn't room for that, though, so I continued to stand, peering down the steep path in search of oncoming druids. I was getting a crick in my back and my feet ached, but it couldn't take long. The streak of light in the east had turned a pale pink, and I supposed it was less than half an hour till dawn. The first one moved almost as silently as Frank. There was only the faintest of rattles as her feet dislodged a pebble near the crest of the hill. And then the neat grey head rose silently into sight, Mrs. Graham. So it was true then. The minister's housekeeper was sensibly dressed in a tweed skirt and woolen coat, with a white bundle under one arm. She disappeared behind one of the standing stones, quiet as a ghost. They came quite quickly after that, in ones and twos and threes, with subdued giggles and whispers on the path that were quickly shushed as they came into sight of the circle. I recognised a few. Here came Mrs. Buchanan, the postmistress, blonde hair freshly permed and the scent of evening in Paris wafting strongly from its waves. I suppressed a laugh, so this was a modern-day druid. There were 15 in all, and all women, ranging in age from Mrs. Graham's 60-odd years to a young woman in her early 20s, whom I had seen pushing a pram around shops 2 days before. All of them were dressed for rough walking, with bundles beneath their arms. With a minimum of chat, they disappeared behind stones or bushes, emerging empty-handed and bare-armed, completely clad in white. I caught the scent of laundry soap as one brushed by our clump of bushes, and recognized the garments as bed sheets wrapped about the body and knotted at the shoulder. They assembled outside the ring of stones in a line from eldest to youngest and stood in silence, waiting. The light in the east grew stronger, and the line of women began to move, walking slowly between two of the stones. The leader took them directly to the center of the circle and led them round and round, still moving slowly, stately as swans in a circular procession. The leader suddenly stopped, raised her arms, and stepped into the center of the circle. Raising her face towards the pair of easternmost stones, she called out in a high voice, not loud but clear enough to be heard throughout the circle. The still mist caught the words and made them echo as though they came from all around, from the stones themselves. Whatever the call was, it was echoed again by the dancers. For dancers they now became, not touching, but with arms outstretched towards each other, they bobbed and weaved, still moving in a circle. Suddenly, the circle split in half. Seven of the dancers moved clockwise, still in a circular motion. The others moved in the opposite direction. The two semicircles passed each other at increasing speed, sometimes forming a complete circle, sometimes a double line. And in the center, the leader stood, stock still, giving, again and again, that mournful, high-pitched call in a language long since dead. They should have been ridiculous, and perhaps they were. A collection of women in bedsheets, many of them stout and far from agile, parading in circles on top of a hill. But the hair prickled on the back of my neck at the sound of their call. They stopped as one and turned to face the rising sun. Standing in the form of two semicircles with a path laying clear between the halves of the circle thus formed. As the sun rose above the horizon, its light flooded between the eastern stones, knifed between the halves of the circle, and struck the great split stone on the opposite side of the hinge. The dancers stood for a moment, frozen in the shadows to either side of the beam of light. Then Mrs. Graham said something in the same strange language, but this time in a speaking voice. She pivoted and walked back straight, iron-grey waves glinting in the sun, along the path of light. Without a word, the dancers fell in step behind her. They passed one by one through the cleft in the main stone and disappeared in silence. We crouched in the alders until the women, now laughing and chatting normally, had retrieved their clothes and set off in a group down the hill, headed for coffee at the manse. Goodness, I stretched, trying to get the kinks out of my legs and back. That was quite a sight, wasn't it? First they mentioned masochism, now kinks. I'm starting to warm up to this book quite a bit. Wonderful, enthused Frank. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. He slipped out of a bush like a snake, leaving me to disentangle myself while he cast about the interior of the circle, nose to the ground, like a bloodhound. Whatever are you looking for? I asked. I entered the circle with some hesitation, but the day was fully come, and the stones, while still impressive, had lost a good deal of the brooding menace of dawn light. Marks, he replied, crawling about on hands and knees, eyes intent on the short turf. How did they know where to stand and stop? Good question. I don't see anything. Casting an eye over the ground, though, I did see an interesting plant growing near the base of one of the tall stones. Myosotis? No, probably not. This had orange centres to the deep blue flowers. Intrigued, I started towards it. Frank, with a keener hearing than I, leapt to his feet, seized my arm, hurrying me out of the circle a moment before one of the morning's dancers entered from the other side. It was Miss Grant, the tubby little woman, who, suitably enough in view of her figure, ran the sweets and pastry shop in High Street. She peered nearsightedly around, then fumbled in her pockets for her spectacles. Jamming these on her nose, she strolled about the circle, at last pouncing on the lost hair clip for which she had returned. Having restored it to its place in her thick, glossy locks, she seemed in no hurry to return to business. Instead, she seated herself on a boulder, leaned back against one of the stone giants in comradely fashion, and lighted a leisurely cigarette. Frank gave a muted sigh of exasperation beside me. "Well," he said, resigned, "we'd best go. She could sit there all morning by the looks of her, and I didn't see any obvious markings in any case." "Perhaps we could come back later," I suggested, still curious about the blue-flowered plant. "Yes, all right." But he had plainly lost interest in the circle itself, being now absorbed in the details of the ceremony. He quizzed me relentlessly on the way down the path, urging me to remember as closely as I could the exact wording of the calls and the timing of the dance. "Norse," he said at last with satisfaction. "The root words are ancient Norse, I'm almost sure of it. But the dance," he shook his head, pondering. "No, the dance is very much older." "Not that there aren't Viking circle dances," he said, raising his brows censoriously, as though I had suggested there weren't. "But that shifting pattern with the double line business, that's, it's like, well, some of the patterns on the Beak of Folk glazeware show a pattern rather like that. But then again, He dropped into one of his scholarly trances, muttering to himself from time to time. The trance was broken only when he stumbled unexpectedly over an obstacle near the bottom of the hill. He flung his arms out with a startled cry as his feet went out from under him and he rolled untidily down the last few feet of the path, fetching up a clump of cow parsley. I dashed down the hill after him, but found him already sitting up among the quivering stems by the time I reached the bottom. "Are you all right?" I asked, though I could see that he was. "I think so." He passed a hand dazedly over his brow, smoothing back the dark hair. "What did I trip over?" "This." I held up a sardine tin, discarded by some earlier visitor. "One of the menaces of civilization." "Ah," he took it from me, peered inside, then tossed it over one shoulder. "Pity it's empty. I'm feeling rather hungry after that excursion. Shall we see what Mrs. Bard can provide in the way of a late breakfast?" "We might," I said, smoothing the last strands of hair for him. "And then again, we might make it to an early lunch instead." My eyes met his. "Ah," he said again, with a completely different tone. He ran a hand slowly up my arm and up the side of my neck, his thumb gently tickling the lobe of my ear. "So we might." "If you aren't too hungry," I said. The other hand found its way behind my back, palm spread. It pressed me gently towards him, fingers stroking lower and lower. His mouth opened slightly as he breathed, ever so lightly, down the neck of my dress, his warm breath tickling the tops of my breasts. He laid me carefully back in the grass, the feathery blossoms of the cow parsley seeming to float in the air around his head. He bent forward and kissed me softly, and kept on kissing me as he unbuttoned my dress, one button at a time, teasing, pausing to reach a hand inside and play with the swelling tips of my breasts. At last, he had the dress laid open from neck to waist. "Ah," he said again, in yet another tone, "like white velvet." He spoke hoarsely and his hair had fallen forward again, but he made no attempt to brush it back. "And yes, just to tease you all further, we'll leave it there and we'll pick it up there next time." I hope you enjoyed listening and reading along and enjoyed the show. Be good and stay kinky as if you had any choice in the matter. See you next time.
You're listening to the Funny Dom podcast. To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.